Hello and welcome to Holden Village. This evening's forum on August the 5th, 1999 is Options at the End of the Tree of Life. Let's listen in.
And I'll be moderating the forum, and I most I'll be getting out of the way so that Mary and Pete can get us going on the topic here. But our title of the forum tonight is called Options at the End of Life, Living Wills and Advanced Directives. And much of the reason that we decided to do this this evening is that Mary and I have been teaching a series this week called Bioethics and Faith that has brought up a whole bunch of different bioethical issues about how we think of difficult ethical situations or medical situations and the ethics. And many of those have to do with end-of-life decisions. So we thought it would be an interesting topic. Mary's had a lot of experience as a social worker in helping people with advanced directives and thinking through those areas. And then Pete, as a medical doctor, has faced many of these same issues from the physician's side. So we thought we'd get them to get us started in a conversation about this. I imagine that many people in the audience tonight also have had experience with these kinds of issues. I wanted to say just a couple things to kind of ground us in the discussions we've been having this week. If you've been here for the bioethics discussions, you know, one of the things that we have talked about is that individuals, at least in our society, have a presumed right to autonomy. That is, they have a right to make decisions about the issues that most deeply affect them, or self-determination. However, oftentimes in end-of-life situations, people are not in a position to be able to make those decisions for themselves. They may be in a coma, they may be in a variety of different states, they may have advanced Alzheimer's, they may have a variety of different reasons why they're not able to. And so when that happens, we move into the realm of surrogacy, that someone else will make decisions about medical or healthcare issues for them, usually next of kin, a spouse, so forth. They'll do that based on one of two different standards. One is substituted judgment. That is, they'll try to know what would be the judgment of the person if she or he were able to make that. However, if no one has communicated that, and that's what we'll be talking about tonight, then it moves into the best interest area here. And medical personnel, by and large, will do that based on a couple different principles. One, beneficence, always act in the best interest to do good to the patient. And also non-maleficence, to prevent or do no harm to the patient. However, what that's understood medically may or may not be in accordance with what you would like done to you. And so that's where it becomes very important to be thinking through these things ahead of time and give advanced directives in that area. So I'm going to turn it over to Mary at this point, and I'll pull the screen down, move out of the way, and then Mary Carlson and Pete Cleaver will shape the conversation here.
Agreed, I'd do the nuts and bolts, and Pete will do the, I was going to say the guts, but that's probably no good. But I like to start off these talks with a little cartoon. This patient is surrounded by artificial liver, artificial heart, artificial stomach. Sorry, it's kind of hard to see it, isn't it? Holding up a sign says, "Please let me die." And the doctor says, "What? And play God?" And the second one, my favorite. I've already made arrangements to be fleshed out. I wouldn't suggest flushing yourself down the toilet or asking anybody to flush the toilet with you in it, but I thought those were both pretty good.
Wow.
Spence, as he said, told you that I've had a lot of experience helping people fill out advanced directives. And it's one of the favorite parts of my job. People say, "Don't you get depressed?" And I say, "No, this is the real stuff. This is the real stuff." All the layers of appearance and clothes and wealth and status disappear when people think about the end of their lives. There was a law passed in this country in 1992, the Patient Self-Determination Act, that made it a national law that all health care providers, hospitals, nursing homes, hospice, home care, must offer their residents or clients or patients the opportunity to fill out an advanced directive. That's the end of the national law. From here on out, what we talk about is state by state, and I won't speak for Pete, but I'm no expert in every state's possibilities. So I'm going to speak in some generalities and then give some specifics about the documents that might be used, and then Pete's going to talk about the kinds of discussions that are important to have with your loved ones, notably your agent and your physicians. The vernacular term for an advanced directive is living will. Many of us who do this a lot hope people quit using that term soon. Why do you suppose?
It's confused with the financial.
Absolutely. People say, I already did my will. My son's the executor. Say, that's great. Good belief for you. A lot of people haven't done that. But that's about when you die, and it's about your property and your assets. Nothing about you or your person. So it's important that people do that. That's its own legal category, but it's financial. So living will is somewhat accurate because it's about when you're alive. But it gets so confused. We suggest people not use it. Depending on where you live, however, the documents available to you to fill out might be called advance directive, healthcare directive, directive to physician, medical care directive, I suppose. Anything else?
Durable power of attorney.
No, that's something else. So these are all, you just ahead of me, John, nice segue, but these are all a similar kind of document, okay? So those terms might be used in your state. Minnesota has just moved to, as of this year, a healthcare directive.
Or declaration.
Oh, declaration is good, yeah. That's sometimes used, thank you. A different document, though sometimes within the same bunches of paper, but with a different purpose, is what John said, the medical power of attorney, sometimes called the health care power of attorney, or a durable power of attorney for health care.
California uses.
Which one? The bottom?
I've heard both, durable power of attorney for health care and healthcare power of attorney, so I don't know that they were just using.
Well, the keys are to have something about medical or health, and the key is to make sure there's a durable clause in it. Mm-hmm. And let me make a comment about that. Over here in the legal arena with money, there are also powers of attorney. Mm-hmm. So somebody might say to you, well, my mom already did a power of attorney, and you say, and what is it for? There is a financial power of attorney that's generally about one page, has a bunch of box, you check off, can she transfer money from savings to checking, can she sell my bonds, my stocks, my property, that kind of thing. So that's why that gets confusing. That's a financial power of attorney. Both kinds of power of attorney, and that's for when you're alive also. That's what it gets confusing too. But both kinds can have, and in my opinion, the healthcare power of attorney should have, a durable clause which says, when and if I am unable to make choices for myself, my autonomy extends through my healthcare agent. But without the durable clause, a power of attorney may end when you become incapable of making a decision for yourself. So you got to look at your form. In Minnesota, the durable power of attorney for medical care does say durable right in it, which means once you can't make decisions, your agent can. Is that clear? It's a lot of blue. Okay, then some states will use agent. Minnesota now has gone to using the term agent. Some use proxy. That is the person you name as your surrogate to make decisions for you, to extend your decision-making right towards the end of your life when you're unable to decide for yourself, but while you are still living. Questions about those documents. Sometimes they're separate. Sometimes they're on one. People sometimes say, if I just do one thing, Mary, if all I can handle is one thing, what would you do? What do you suppose? One of these. Name an agent. If you do nothing else up here, name an agent. And I'm going to talk just a minute about how you pick an agent. One thing about these documents is they do not require an attorney to fill out. So a lot of people think they have to go pay big bucks. They require somebody who knows you well to witness it. Most documents require two witnesses who sign and say, yes, this person is of sound mind, they're not under duress, not under pressure to do this or that or the other thing. Or they might be notarized by a notary public, which sometimes costs a buck, sometimes it's free, depending on where you work and who you know. So one or the other can be done. It does not require an attorney. I do, however, suggest that when you get to doing this more complex thinking and consideration, that you do think about having somebody, a professional, help you do it. You don't have to. I'm going to give you some simple ways to do it. But it can be a minister who knows what he or she is talking about. And that's important. Not all ministers are prepared to do these discussions, in my opinion, humble as it is. Not all social workers by any means are prepared to do this. Not all physicians, in my opinion, do this well. I would not go to my orthopedic surgeon and say, talk to me about advanced directives. Who am I missing? Well, mental health nurses. I mean, a number of people could do it. Lawyers, but a tax lawyer should not help fill out a healthcare power of attorney or advanced directive, in my opinion. So it is helpful to have somebody who knows, but you don't have to have somebody who knows. Okay? Somebody got a hand up.
No, I think I'll just...
Okay, let me talk for 2 minutes about how to pick somebody. If somebody gets to end of life, can't make choices for him or herself, hasn't done any of this, which is true for about 70% of people in our country, 70-75% have done no advanced directives.
So I view it as my mission, and I thank Dan.
If they haven't done it, then who decides for people? It goes by whatever in the state statute says is next of kin. So for an adult who's 35, unmarried, it's parents if they're living. For an adult who's 60 and unmarried, it's parents who are living. For adults who are 75 and widowed, it's children if they have them. And it's in a certain order. And then it goes further to siblings and aunts and uncles and things like that. So that's important for people to understand, because a lot of folks don't think about that ahead of time. And I have a lot of gay and lesbian friends who can't be legally married and are caught unawares. When this happens, if they've done no advanced planning, your partner has zero say, zero. So that's important. So can you choose an agent? Yes, you can. And here are the things that I suggest. It isn't necessarily your family members, but it may well be. If you're married and your spouse is living, it's your spouse. Unless you say, I don't want my spouse. Or your spouse says, I don't want to be the one. And we'll come to some reasons why. So here are some of the things you think about. Your agent should be someone you trust. Someone who will hold similar values and beliefs about medical care and about death and dying. Someone who won't be intimidated by others who may want to take control or disagree. Could be a spouse says, look, I couldn't bear it if our daughter came and said, Mom, what are you doing? I don't want to be in charge of it. Make my daughter do it. I'll agree with her. Could be. Your agent should be someone who will serve as a real advocate for your interests. This person is substituting your judgment, what you would have wanted, not what this person would have wanted for you. What you would have wanted. Real advocate for what you would have wanted. Your agent should be someone who can cope with the emotional burdens that may come with making difficult life and death decisions. Can't stress that enough. It is a horribly difficult, extremely powerful, can be wonderful experience to be an agent. That person needs to be as prepared as we can be, and we never know how that's going to go. But somebody who can emotionally handle it. Here's another one. Someone who will be available. I was thinking this morning about my brother John. In Chicago, the rest of us are elsewhere. I wonder who he has designated. I suspect he hasn't, so I need to write him. I have my living will here, by the way, my advanced directive, if anybody wants to take a look. I haven't updated it. It's 3 years. I have to look at it. But somebody who will be available when something happens. Should you be in a car crash and you're not able to respond, can they find that person? Somebody who goes to Europe half the year to study wouldn't be a useful agent. Somebody you can talk with ahead of time about sensitive issues and is willing to listen to you. This is an important one. Somebody who's willing and really able to carry out your preferences and not be too close to you to let you die, if that's what you want. Somebody who's not too close to you to let you die, if that's your choice. You can have one agent or you can have a couple. You can designate one and a backup, one and two backups, but you need to designate whether it's one primary who has sole responsibility or it's two people who must agree. Well, which can get problematic, but some people have two kids that can't choose, they will agree, they'll have to agree. The risk you take is if one doesn't agree, the physicians, correct me if I'm wrong, will do the least litigious possibility and the most for sustaining life at all costs. Mm-hmm. Careful how I use those words. And a proxy can be a family member, a friend, a partner. In a very rare instance, it can be a healthcare provider for, say, the homeless person who's been unattached to family for years and doesn't feel that the friends in his or her community can be doing that. It can be a healthcare provider, though there are usually some precautions taken, like who the agent can't be the one who witnesses the advance directive and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Okay. You haven't made out and you have a spouse, but the spouse is deceased and you have the children mentioned. Do you have to have that redone?
Say it again, if you'd listed the spouse?
Yeah.
If there's more than one child, I'd have it redone to either say one child.
But then the child is mentioned who you wanted if the spouse is not able to.
Oh, then it's probably okay. Yeah, if there's one child's name on it. Yeah, I think that would be okay. Or two. Yeah.
My experience has been, too, that if there are two children, it's the one that lives the furthest away that has the most difficulty.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm.
I laughed last week. I had mentioned the California daughter coming to Minnesota. I had two different healthcare people come up later, one from Michigan, one from Wisconsin. They say, that California daughter comes to Michigan and Wisconsin, too. One who flies in and says, this is what we should do and hasn't been around.
Yeah,
yeah, that's why it's very problematic to have people joint agents. The only last thing I would say is to revisit it every couple years. Whenever a situation changes, if you get a new diagnosis, if you move to a new state, if somebody dies who was the agent or becomes unavailable, it's just wise to check it out. Actually, I have two other things to say. One is, how many copies do you make, and where do you keep the original?
Where do you get it?
Oh, where do you get it first? You should be able to get it at your doctor's office, the hospital.
Local health care, any nursing home, public health department, libraries, stores have forms, library, probably off the internet, and
some of you who want to, this organization called Five Wishes is printing sort of a standardized 5-point advance directive, and there's an internet site on here listed and an address. You could look at that. I can't vouch for this. The article said what he has, this guy has, will do in Minnesota. It's substantially like our Minnesota law. So two things about where the original is once you do it. You keep it, and you don't keep it unfindable. You don't put it down at the bank in the safety deposit box. You keep it in an obvious drawer right under the telephone, or you keep it right up next to the phone books, or with your savings account stuff. And then who do you give copies to? Give it to the agent, the surrogate.
The doctor.
The doctor, ideally you have one primary doc. Give it to the doc. In our place, you can take it to the hospital and hand it to the receptionist. Say, put this in my record. If you've been there, they'll have a record. If you don't, they'll kind of look at you like, well, we don't have a record.
Carry one with you.
Could carry one with you, yeah. Could also carry a little note in your wallet that says, I have an advance directive. It is blah, blah. This is where it is. You should give one to your attorney if you have one. You should give one to a minister if you care, if that person will be around at this situation with your family, if it's someone you know and trust. You should also give one to anybody who thinks they're going to have something to say about you, who isn't an agent. This is a service to your agent. This is, yeah, some people have 10, 12 copies up. And that's perfectly fine until you update it.
Yeah.
And then you need to update all 12 and tell them to get rid of it. But even if someone comes in with an out-of-date one and your proxy has the updated one with a more recent date, that's what they go by. They don't go by old ones. If you live half the year in Arizona or California, from Alaska or Minnesota or Washington, you need to have one in each state. You should have one in any state you spend significant time in. If you have a lake home somewhere, check those laws. Just to cover your bases, because there's no guarantee that one from one state will fit for another state, though we're moving towards some general language that most states will recognize. We're not there yet. Not there to quiet so people can talk. So we'll come back to it. Yeah.
One thing that was helpful, because my daughter is my primary, and I have a friend who's been a helper, but she said, well, what will I know that you don't want? And so we had like a situational piece of paper that if I had this and this and this, what would I want?
What a segue. What a segue. Because if you just do the durable power, it's very simple. If you do an advanced directive, it likely is a number of pages, 3 to 5 or 6 pages with possible scenarios that cover 5 or 6 basic areas of medical stuff to think about. And the caveat is you can't ever know what's going to be your situation, and you can't try to.
But it's real clear when you look at my papers what I want and don't want.
Yep.
Right. I wondered if it might help if I add my voice at this point because of my experience. I've been in an emergency room and ICU chaplain for 10 years now, and I can't. I'm wanting to support what Mary's been saying. I've been with families hundreds of times, even those who have advanced directives, who haven't really made clear to all the people who would want to help make that final decision about withdrawing from life support or whatever, those kinds of major decisions. So it's very, very important to make your feelings made known, because I can't overemphasize, physicians in emergency rooms and ICUs, they feel that they're God, and their right is to make you live as long as they can. And if you haven't named a durable power attorney or agent, you haven't made clear your wishes, you're going to be extended through a long, long time. I've seen people kept in those situations for months because this sort of thing wasn't done. And the other thing is, don't just assume that person closest to you is going to be the right person. I can't tell you the number of times I've seen people change their minds, even though their spouse or brother had said clearly, I do not want to be kept on life support. They have second thoughts. Can I really do this to my loved one?
Thank you.
Those are really good points. I think the other important thing is to add to Mary's part of this was, I think in discussing with patients, I discuss it with everybody I see, and I think every physician should do that. It's required at some hospitals. Usually administrators are the ones who fulfill the law part of it, but beyond that, we try and discuss it with everybody. And I inevitably get the comment from younger people that, why do I need to do this? So it's really important that everybody, no matter what your age, what your health, because it can come into effect at any time. Car crashes, accidents happen. It's not just people with cancer or elderly that have to do this. It's really important. Everybody have it. I have mine written out very specifically and with conditions specifically written out, which I'll go into. And also I have everything written out as far as funeral directives. My ashes will be spread in the compost here at Holden.
The last garbology.
The last garbology. So, but it's really important that everybody have that. As far as the specific discussions and things you need to really think about, what kind of medical interventions you need to talk about, whether you want them or not, there's different levels. You start off with the most extreme, what we call extraordinary measures, which is this, usually where most discussions stop in the emergency room in an initial assessment. That would include CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, the actual act of doing CPR, where you use chest compressions and ventilator bagging. That also includes electrical shock to the heart if your heart should stop. Or if you should have a rhythm that's unusual, that's life-threatening. And then the final, what we call extraordinary means, would be actually putting a tube down through the throat into the lungs to help you breathe and hooking you up to a ventilator, a machine that helps you breathe. Those are all what we call extraordinary means when we discuss those things, mainly because they're prolonging a function that has stopped on you. It used to be that when we had that discussion, we had to honestly say, once you're on these things, it's very difficult to get taken off. That's not true anymore. It's much easier legally to withdraw life support from people. And it's routinely done after discussions just between the physician and family or surrogate. So it's changed the way people look at that a little bit. But it's still, you have to you have to be as graphic as you possibly can when you discuss these things. What happens during what we call a code, where all these things are done, can be a very, I would even consider it a violent thing. It's a very traumatic and violent thing to have somebody shocked, have them intubated with a tube, and to have CPR done to them. There's no guarantee when that's done that the person will live afterwards, or have a functional life or good quality of life after that if they do live. And I think it can, CPR has changed, and electrical cardioversion has changed survival rates dramatically from, but when you consider that the alternative was just death, anything brings up the statistics. Most statistics still show that most people, even in the hospital, do not survive a code situation. And people who do often have brain disorder afterwards from the lack of blood flow to their brain. The exception is that people do come through, and we can't ever predict that before it's done. People want to know, what are my chances? You can't say that. You can't, because it's going to depend on how sick you are beforehand, what causes the initial event for your heart to stop or for you to stop breathing, and it depends on how long things have to be done and how fast they're done. So there's no guarantees. And so you have to keep that all in mind, and there are no answers to that. It's a very personal preference. There's all kinds of situations where somebody could just have a sudden death and have the equipment right there and then be brought back very quickly. But there's other cases where people have a number of medical conditions beforehand that make it very unlikely for them to be brought back. So there are no guarantees on that. Beyond that, there's a whole other set of issues that you need to talk to them about should other circumstances happen to you. If you should go into a coma, have a stroke, have something that debilitates you to the point where you can't think for yourself, you might be if you're in a car accident, you might have, or other trauma, you might be in what's called a persistent vegetative state, where you have, it's not a coma, there's still reflexes, responses that don't occur during a coma. I don't want to get too technical on the definitions of it, but essentially there's very little chance of coming out of that state. That's why it's persistent. After a certain point, there's neurologists can say that there's very slim chance of you recovering any cognitive function where you actually have response to people in a meaningful way. In those cases, you have to decide what you want done to support you. These are things that are added. If you're not able to eat, you might have a feeding tube put in. And that's not just the one down the nose that goes into you. They would actually make an incision and put a tube directly into your stomach or your intestine to feed you. That's one form of what we call, you know, nutritional support. The other form would just be IV fluids. Do you want to be hydrated? Do you want to have fluids because you can't drink fluids? The other things you need to consider are, do you want certain medicines given to you? More specifically, the ones that come up most often, because people often in these states get infections, like urinary tract infections or lung infections, would be antibiotics. If you get an infection in that state, chances are it will probably cause you to die. And do you want to have antibiotics given to you to prolong your situation? That even though you don't have a chance of coming out of that, do you want to have recovery from that? It used to be said, a very famous surgeon and medical person, Dr. Osler, used to say that pneumonia was an old person's friend, that it kept them from being prolonged suffering through other states and conditions. And that's a lot of people's feelings still, but you have to decide that for yourself.
This really is beginning to sound very complicated.
It is.
And so, to simplify, couldn't we just say, I want no invasive procedures and only medicine to alleviate the pain?
Period. That's one. You can do it that way. That's the last level of decision making you have to make after all these other things is comfort care. But that even gets to be a gray area, because people have different feelings about what would be comfortable in a situation like that. Is not being hydrated comfortable? So if you don't have IV fluids, some people feel that they don't want a person to go through that, that they might be thirsty or hungry, or is oxygen a comfort measure if the person's having trouble breathing in that state? Is an infection uncomfortable? So you have to still decide those issues, even if you want to state only things that are going to alleviate pain, because those things can add, in some people's mind, to pain. Now, it's generally believed that people in those states, through a number of methods, they don't feel necessarily hunger or thirst or those sort of things, but that's each individual person's perception. So you still have to decide those things, because they can be comfort measures, considered comfort measures themselves.
That's why using vague terms like do everything, because you can use an advanced directive to say, keep me going. I don't care what you do, respirator and artificial nutrition, you can use it for that. It isn't just to use it for not doing things. That's important to stress. But do everything to an 80-year-old growing up in a different era means something different than it does to a 28-year-old ER physician.
And in my experience, the best thing you can do is to be as specific as you possibly can in your durable power of attorney or living will, listing all these things. And that's why it's a really good idea for you to get together with your healthcare practitioner or somebody like Mary who's familiar with these instruments and what might happen, and talk about each individual thing that might happen to you in different conditions. You know, what might happen to you right away if you had a cardiac arrest? What might happen to you if you were in a persistent vegetative state? And what things you would want done or not want done if you'd want to be allowed to die in those situations?
I was just going to add that most states have standardized forms that kind of talk you through the process, too. So it's not like you have to sit down with a blank piece of paper and say, and remember, now, what was I supposed to have done?
But you're right. It is very complicated. I mean, and as the technology gets more and more advanced, you know, more and more things come in that it's hard for, you know, medical personnel to keep up with, and how to discuss that with people and what the options are. You know, I've even delineated whether I want certain transplants in certain cases, and specifically bone marrow transplants and things like that. You have all those things are going to start to become more and more issues. You know, different types of therapies.
That's why the agent needs to know you well.
Yes.
And one thing that's really helpful for people who are religious to say, if you think this is true, death is not the worst thing that can happen
that's
to
right.
me. That's a helpful general guide for an agent who's faced with some bizarre situation that you never could have thought of. But your agent said, well, this person who I loved and cared about believed that death wasn't the end.
Yeah.
That wasn't the worst thing. There were worse things, so it's okay to not do this.
We are trying to have a change in medical care these days. It's the tradition's been that the physician and healthcare professional's there to keep that person alive. John's right. I mean, that's the tradition in medicine, is to keep people alive, and it's been at all costs. And things are changing somewhat, but slowly, and you have to be aware that that healthcare provider's main goal was to keep you alive.
But through all of this, aren't we being haunted by lawyers who are ready to sue?
Yeah, to a certain extent. Yeah, I mean, legalistic issues come into it.
So that's why.
But most of these things are decided without lawyers involved, and without.
They get involved rarely,
yeah.
And it's going to be when something isn't very clear and somebody's disagreeing. But that's why you do need an agent to say very clearly, "Look, here it is, and this is it, and there's no arguing here."
And another thing that I'm advising people to do these days, just because everybody seems to have access to a video camera, is to videotape yourself actually saying these things. Because it's very hard for a court to argue, or anybody else, loved ones or anybody else, to argue with you standing there saying, this is what I don't want. So that if you have people, you know, family members or other people who are interested in this person coming in and arguing a different line, show them the video. And you have support. And as an advocate or an agent, that's very supportive, you know.
I want to raise a question that I found very troubling, and seeing get your response. About 3 or 4 years ago, I think it may have been a little longer. There was a national study done, and remember the headline in the newspaper was, it said the vast majority of people die the way they fear.
Right.
And that advanced directives were routinely ignored or overridden. So what? So even if you do all this stuff, how do you best protect yourself so that you, I mean, it was an astonishingly high number, like 80 to 90% people died the way they were most afraid of dying.
And it's common for people in ERs that work in ERs to talk about having do not resuscitate tattooed on their chest.
And that doesn't count.
Why would they ignore your?
It's not that they necessarily ignore it. It's just that they don't have that information available.
Transferred to a nursing home, it doesn't go along with
right.
them. In a teaching hospital where every 2 days, every 3 weeks, the staff changes, going from ER to ICU, new docs, agent gets intimidated and overwhelmed by a physician or 10 who come in and say, we need to do this, and this is what's happening, 8 specialists. So one thing you do is you have an agent who will speak up.
Yeah, it has to be.
Regularly, every day it's needed. No, I know you're a new doc and you're a specialist, but this person didn't want this invasive this, whatever it is.
And,
hard
you know,
to do
it's,
that.
They, as a physician or a healthcare provider that knows about specific orders to not do those things, if you do those things, you can be held criminally liable under battery charges. So it's just a matter of getting that information available to people. It used to be that paramedics would not be allowed to do not resuscitate orders in the field. And that's changed quite a bit now also, especially with the availability of communications. They can check, you know, they'll call into a base station and get an okay. And so even now at home, if paramedics respond to somebody, they can call it there. It's still difficult in some places.
You can pour them right on your refrigerator.
You can.
Yeah.
You can.
I don't know what it's called.
Yep, where you look at it every day.
It seems to me that there can be some problems with deciding whether this is end of life or whether this is part of a accepted medical procedure, thinking in terms of breathing tubes with bypass surgery and so on, you are on resuscitation.
And that's been another big issue that's being decided now among a lot of bioethics people is it's routine that somebody might have a do not resuscitate order in the hospital, but if they're taken for a surgery and they're put on a ventilator for the surgery and then have an arrest during the surgery because of something, a blood loss during the surgery, a lot of times surgeons will disregard the do not resuscitate order because of what we call iatrogenic, which means that it's physician or healthcare provider caused. This wasn't a natural thing that just happened. It was because of something they were doing. And so they feel that they must correct that situation. That's changing a lot, and there's a lot of discussion among, especially in the surgery profession, about obeying do not resuscitate orders, even though it happens during surgery.
Our hospital just went through this policy in Northfield, and the big stickler was it meant that the surgeon or the anesthesiologist had to do this discussion with the patient before surgery. And these are not two specialties who normally do the DNR
right.
discussions. They were reluctantly saying, yeah, we need to do it. That's where it's helpful to use a term in your advanced directive like, if I'm diagnosed with an irreversible situation where I can't breathe, there are times we know it's irreversible, barring a medical miracle, which we have to admit happens sometimes. But people need feeding tubes for a month while they have a blockage of their intestine or something. You might say, look, if it looks like it's short term, go ahead and use it. If it gets to be more than a year or two and I'm not conscious otherwise or something, take it out. That kind of thing can be useful. But you're right, there are those temporary fixes.
A comment about ambiguous terms. Please don't use the word terminal. I've seen so many that say, if I have a terminal illness, I do not want this and this. Who knows? Only her father knows if it's terminal or not. We don't know.
We had our advanced directive in Minnesota till this year was only allowable and legal when people were terminally ill.
Yeah.
As decided by two physicians that this person had less than 6 months to live. And because of that very issue, the legislature, in its wisdom, saw to do away with that because people in PVS, are they terminally ill? People with advanced Alzheimer's, are they terminally ill? So now it's for any situation when they don't have decisional capacity.
Also in Minnesota, just now this year, there's a new document called a healthcare declaration, which combines both the advance directive and the healthcare power of attorney. And you can fill out either one or both. Okay. So,
I have a copy left from last week, and there's a nice little worksheet goes right along with it. And I tell people, give the worksheet to your agent. You've sat down, you've written out some things. Give the whole business to them, that person.
Can you make more copies?
I'll have to check with the powers that be at the village.
Sure.
The powers that be were at my right hand. Yes, it's the Minnesota one, so.
Mary, I wonder if I could ask Karen to reflect a little bit on the areas that you considered important enough to include in your directives. And you said, if this happens, then this. So did you think of head injuries, heart? I mean, what kind of things did you think of?
Everything. I really didn't want any of the things. I'm trying to remember what was on the list, but it was some kind of a head injury, trauma kind of thing. And then there was that I would be quadriplegic or mentally disabled and or mentally disabled. Not the same, you know, there were different scenarios, and I'm sorry, I don't remember what they were, but, and then I added a few more that I didn't want to live through. And the only other thing that I would say to you is that she very easily says, pull the tube out. Every family that I have had who's had a PEG, which is a tube in the stomach, or any kind of tube, IVs, anything, it's the hardest thing to pull those. So if you let those go in, it's really guilt-ridden people who pull those things. Families struggle with that pulling. If it never gets put in, it's more gentle.
So the suggestion is, just don't have them in the
Think it through right? Like she's telling you to think it through ahead of time. Because
it's
if things get taken care of.
When you're discussing to go through specific situations and what happens, just go through, just make up a case with your agent, just see how they react to it and see how they deal with it. And make it as graphic as you possibly can, because believe me, when you get in those, it's incredibly emotional. You may have talked with somebody, I mean, I've been in situations where I've been an advocate for somebody and had to make a decision, and it's very hard. It's when you're right there in the heat of the situation to make that decision.
And remember that what Pete described to you as CPR happens in less time than it took him to tell you about it.
Yeah.
I mean, the time that he told you the whole story, it would be, that takes, I mean, all of the stuff that he told you, it happens in minutes, seconds to minutes, and so, you know, it's hardly time to think. It's just a reaction in the medical profession.
And you've really, when you go and see your healthcare providers, make sure you sit down with them and tell them that you want to discuss this. Healthcare providers these days are under a tremendous amount of pressure to move people through, and you got to make them accountable for talking to you about this, because to me it's one of the most important things you could talk to them about.
So Pete, if I'm your patient and I come and say, I know that CPR isn't really great, statistically speaking, it's not as good as it is on ER. Even for me, and I'm only 42. But, you know, I'd like him, since I'm only 42, I'm pretty healthy, I'd like him to try for a little while.
Well, I mean, there used to be a thing called a slow code. and you know, this is something
pink.
That has been,
pink in our
has been now labeled very unethical. I think I agree with it. It was a situation where somebody would come in with a serious health problem. This is the most common time when it came up, especially during residency. And they have serious health problems, especially like breathing problems or cardiac problems that you know is pretty futile, that they have very, very slim chance of surviving a code situation. Family members or the person really wants everything done. Or you don't want to even discuss it with them or whatever, right? And so they wind up with what we call a full code, everything to be done, but you don't feel good about that. And so there used to be a thing that people would say, well, they're a slow code. That means you only do a few times, or you only do give them electrical shock but don't intubate them. And that is really unethical.
You should either do it or you don't.
And I also have people, when I'm discussing it with it, say, well, geez, the electrical shock sounds okay, but I don't want that tube in there.
Right, so they can put a
They can do that, and you can split it off, and it should be discussed separately. But you should also know that electrical shock without intubation won't do anything.
Yeah.
Just like CPR alone won't do anything without the cardioversion. So I try and make that clear to them. But any person has a right to say, I want just CPR, or I just want intubation without the rest of it, as long as I've made it clear to them that that's futile. It's their decision to make. Healthcare providers are really only your advisors. They're not there to tell you what to do. You have to make the decisions as hard as they are.
Well, then with a diabetic, too, if you don't get the insulin.
Right, same thing, yeah. But a person can refuse insulin if they want. Patients have a right to refuse medical care anytime they want, as long as it's been discussed with them about the benefits and risks.
It seems to me that in today's world, where people have not done as you've suggested, and there are many, that a situation arises, and all of a sudden there's a committee meeting, and a very short time, and I don't know how short, that a decision has to be made on these matters. It seems like, a physician and a social worker and a couple other people and an agent, and okay, these are the options, bing, 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 yes or no, go. Is it that rapid?
Can be. In an emergency situation, it can be.
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't take a whole committee. Sometimes it's the doc and the agent. Most of the time, that's who it is, making the decisions right there. If anybody, however, has some level of question or discomfort or wants more time to sort it out, and there is more time, then anybody can request an ethics consultation in a healthcare situation. Anybody.
In some conditions, it takes a while. Like, say, a stroke, a really severe stroke. I advise people never to make a decision within the first 48 hours because you don't know. You know, scientific studies show that you can't tell in the first 48 hours what somebody's prognosis or chances of survival or what their function's going to be in that first 48 hours.
In that first 48 hours, would they not be hooked up to all this stuff?
They could be.
Which then gets to the situation of unhooking it is very difficult.
But I think in those cases, I always make sure that they understand that they have to make this decision with the knowledge that they're going to have to look back on it without regret or feeling guilt. Or the least amount of guilt. I don't think anybody's ever made these decisions without feeling guilty. I think that's a normal reaction. But I think that they need to have that time. I don't want people to make that kind of rash decision. And I think it is much easier to have those things taken out these days than it used to be. And Karen's right, it is a difficult thing to do. But I think it's also difficult to have to face the fact that what if we had done this? Would they have survived? Would they have had function? When the doctors are telling us that 48 hours, you don't know.
We also have stopped, in many cases, pulling out. We just don't give
you
the
just
next
turn off.
Feeding.
Yeah.
Just cover up the peg or don't give the next.
Yeah,
blood.
Yeah.
Which is different,
but
again,
it's still
for
hard
families.
To stop the feed.
Sure it is. Sure it is. I had a funny situation is I sometimes think that I push too much this don't do stuff, just let it go, you know. That's my own personal way of doing this. But I interviewed a bunch of people in the state of Minnesota about these discussions they had with their doctor or nurse or social worker. One guy right in my community said very clearly to me, I am so clear with my doctor. No CPR, no respirator, no artificial fluids, no artificial nutrition. And I'm all worried about the loopholes, you know, the medic who finds me, or I'm at my friend's house and they take me to the ER and they do it. You know, why not have a bracelet that says DNR? I'm surprised we haven't done that yet. Why not do it on my forehead or my chest? And he asked about that loophole, and I said, it's a loophole. That happens. So about 6 months later, I'm reading the Northfield News, and there's this little thank you so much to the nurses and doctors of Northfield Hospital signed this person. And I let go of my research ethics the next time I saw him. This is rural. So I said, Jack, I'm taking my research hat off. What happened that you said thank you? He said, well, I was out shoveling. I had a heart attack. The neighbor boy came over and started CPR and saved my life. And I'm thrilled. I've changed all my orders, and I feel I have a new lease. God gave me this lease. And this guy was so worried that he'd be a loophole and be living, you know, in a persistent vegetative state or, you know, in a nursing home without all his brain function or something, and here he was. So he kept me humble. Me preaches about this and says, don't let them do everything to you. He was thrilled to be alive again. So there you go. And the neighbor kid didn't know he had an advanced directive. He didn't give that kid a, you know, a copy. It's a great story.
Yeah.
It just reminds us that even those of us who preach about this a lot need to be humbled.
And that's why it's so important to keep revisiting it. I mean, my dad, and some of you met my dad when he was up here, but he gives me a hard time because he's been through some very close calls and always gives me a hard time about us making the decision for him or whatever. But even when he was up here, I asked him, you know, get this new defibrillator. You want me to use that on you? I don't know. You know, every time he has to rethink
it.
And, you know, inevitably he says no. But you need to revisit every situation all the time with the people are important.
Hearing the discussion about no CPR, and then I'm thinking of all of the training and in all of our schools now, kids are taught CPR, and as though it's one of those things that everyone must know how to do because you're going to need to do that for whatever.
Well, it has changed things drastically. I mean, Seattle was the prime city for that.
It started here, didn't it? Sort of training of CPR
with
Seattle.
They've had incredible success with it in the field, but I can't remember, how does that saying go? Seattle's the best place to have a heart attack, but the worst place to, I can't remember. It's something about dying. It's the worst place to try and die.
Yeah, because it's successful in getting hearts beating again.
Yeah.
Is it successful in getting the person out of the healthcare facility and back to the life he or she was living?
And, how do you judge success? I mean, if you save one person, you know, I consider that a huge success.
Look at your...
So, you know, if you have a chance to do that, but then you always have to look at the alternative, which is technology always has a good side and a bad side to things, and you have to look at what you're willing to put up with for success to make it worthwhile.
I think one of the alternatives that people haven't talked a lot about doing things and doing CPR. And if you have an agent and your agent is your spouse and you have a crummy disease and you're going to die, there's nothing wrong with your spouse sitting there with you, holding your hand, holding you, and not calling 911.
Exactly.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I think everybody's got to know that.
Yeah.
You know, that's not,
murder.
Yeah. I mean, it's whatever you want. It's what you and your spouse or your agent decided before that, you know. Yeah. In a lot of situations, it's going to be the spouse, but... Nothing wrong with holding somebody's hand while they die. Yeah. It's a hell of a lot nicer than having somebody beat on your chest.
Yeah.
Pardon my French.
You have my attitude.
Yeah.
How does age figure into what decisions are made to do some of these kinds of, like CPR? If you have, say, a young person in his or her 20s or 30s, is CPR less likely to do damage and more likely to... than say an 8-year-old.
Yeah, just statistically, just because young people have less pre-existing health conditions, which make their chances greater of surviving. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about, you know, 3% versus 8%. I mean, it's still not that huge a difference. When somebody's heart stops, there's a certain process that goes on, and depending on what caused it. It's a very serious thing. It's very hard to get people to come back from sometimes.
So CPR is really not a successful procedure?
No, I think it is. I mean, like I said, it depends on what you call successful. Yeah.
Well, the highest, we reviewed for this study, all the medical literature about success of CPR, and we defined it as leaving the hospital, being discharged from the ICU, the medical unit, discharge from the hospital back home as success. That's how we define it. We look through studies. The best chance was 38%. And that was people who had an arrest in the hospital where people were there with the crash carts to do it.
And that's just being discharged.
Yeah, that's just being discharged. That's not saying what situation you're in. That's not saying you're back walking around feeling good. The other one, my dad had a heart attack at 48, and the choir director did CPR in the church, and he lived for a whole month in the hospital aware and talked to us the whole time. And we had time to visit, and then he had another one and died. Without CPR that choir director had learned, we wouldn't have had a whole month with my dad to say goodbye. So success there, absolutamente yes. But then
like I
died.
Said, I mean, saving one person's success. I mean, you know, if you train enough people and you save one or two people, I mean, that's right there is a success, even if it's a small percentage. But you still have to be aware that most people don't make it through that.
What is being taught in our Lutheran seminaries now concerning these end-of-life options?
Well, is anybody in seminary? You can speak.
Not
I think
much.
It's still a pastoral care is still elective. I don't think anybody has to learn this stuff in seminary.
No counseling training specifically.
Well, no, that's not true. We all have to take counseling. We have to take some pastoral care and counseling. And now everyone has to take...
required in every seminary?
Take
Some level of it is required in all Lutheran seminaries.
Okay.
There are real strong recommendations for every seminarian to have at least a quarter of clinical education.
Right. Yeah.
But that's a recommendation, not a requirement.
That's maybe what I was thinking of. So the CPE is not required.
Right.
Yeah.
Sounds like they're behind the curve.
Interestingly enough, in the facility I work in, it's the chaplains who do the advanced directives education for patients. And there are three chaplains, staff chaplains, who one of whom I am, and we share that responsibility to do that education.
Not all hospitals have chaplains there all of the time.
That's right. Right. Oh, 2 minutes. Yeah, a couple more questions or comments?
One bit of information that I'm aware of, and I suspect that it's dated, and that is in terms of success rate for CPR, and that was for people who are chronically ill, who are aged or very young, those success rates are less than 5%.
Yeah, the study that we did of all the lit review, it was between 3 and probably 8%.
One option that we often recommend to people is to have a trial of therapy, if that's a concern. It's an option that you can choose, and you can time delineate that trial of therapy, and you can spell out what you want included in that or not.
Yeah, a lot of expertise in this room.
Yeah.
Yeah, some of the data that's been talked about tonight doesn't hold for pediatric patients. You just have to know that. Mm-hmm. Pediatric patients respond to CPR better than 65-year-old patients respond to CPR, because usually most of them don't have cardiac arrest. They have respiratory arrest. So going through the same procedures and you're doing five different things at one time, and the kid wakes up and is eating breakfast the next morning, you don't know which one really. You don't know which one of the five made a difference. But I wouldn't take some of the data that.
That's right. This is all adult, and advanced directives can only be you can only be 18 and over to do.
Right. The other thing that I would throw in from a pediatric point of view is that somebody brought up advanced DNRs before, and when you have a child and a child has a lethal disease, a terminal disease, whatever you want to call it, you know this kid has a downhill disease. He's going to die from it. Usually involves the central nervous system. You talk to the parents, the mother, the father, both of them together, and you decide that this after the fourth hospitalization in 2 months that the child is going to be made a DNR. A kid gets better, goes home, comes back in, and you have to do that same talk all over again. There is no such thing as once it's on the books, it's on the books. Once it's on the books for that hospitalization, it's on the books, and it's only good in the state of Alaska for 10 days. So every 10 days, then you have to talk about it. If you think that's not guilt-provoking for talking to the parents about it, as well as talking to the pediatrician or any other chaplains or everybody else who's talking, it's really a terrific thing to do for your kid, because nobody wants their kid to die before they die. It's a horrendous thing.
Well, that's very useful to hear the difference for pediatrics too. Well, thank you.
Yeah, we've reached the end of our time. Just about holding forums as they start conversations rather than end them, so I hope that this will be a way to keep these conversations going, and thank everybody for coming tonight. And I invite folks to come when we'll start at about 25 minutes to 10 o'clock if you want to stay with us.
Just give a round of applause. Yeah,